relaxing game, or maybe even your favorite show. Give your body some love with the personal care it needs, and get ready to sleep your face off. Chapter 15. Sleep. Sleep turns the dreams about your health into a reality. Aubrey Marcus. We have arrived at the bridge that takes us from today to tomorrow. How we cross it determines whether one good day will lead to another and another. Finish your day strong, my friend. Finish it right. And go the fuck to sleep. Of course, it's not so simple. Sleeping well and sleeping right take work, too. It's not just lying down and letting it happen. But you need to do it. You own your sleep, and you own your day. Getting owned. She was one of the most powerful women in the world. She graced the covers of magazines and had powerful people on her speed dial. She had a Brentwood mansion and was building a media empire. And that was on top of a successful life she'd already built involved in politics and writing best-selling books. She worked so hard she had a team of assistants on both coasts who could barely keep up with her. She was a mover and shaker, a rock star whose every decision was studied and written about. Successful by every metric we use to measure success. But there came a moment when none of it mattered. Collapsed on the floor, her cheek cracked open, lying in a pool of her own blood, Arianna Huffington had fallen from exhaustion, hitting her face on her desk on the way down. She had pushed herself beyond what was reasonable, pulled one too many late nights, became addicted to her phone, her website, her lifestyle, and the pull and thrill of success. She had become consumed by it all, and it had all come crashing down, literally. It was this moment that Arianna Huffington points to as the one where it all became clear for her. Huffington's doctors told her she was exhausted, depleted to the marrow of her bones. The famous 19th century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer once said, "Sleep is the interest we have to pay on the capital which is called in at death. The higher the interest rate and the more regularly it is paid, the further the date of redemption is postponed." Arianna Huffington was months behind on her payments, and she was looking at a fatal foreclosure if she didn't get caught up. She isn't the only one. We are sleeping less than we ever have. Over 60% of people in the United States report sleep difficulties, more than ever before. It is an epidemic, one that is largely self-inflicted. After all, how many of us just assume when faced with a choice in our schedule that sleep's got to be the first thing to go? "I'm just too busy," we say, or "I'll sleep when I'm dead," or "but Bill Clinton never slept." Some people actually feel real guilt for sleeping. As much of a champion as I am of personal accountability, I can't put the blame for how perversely we've been guilted into a sleepless schedule squarely at our own feet. The man shares a good deal of the blame. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, it became advantageous to get people to work early and keep them there as long as possible. We still do this today. Why do you think Google has gyms and cafeterias and foosball tables all over their campus? To keep Googlers at the office. Since Western industrialized society adopted this approach to work, we have increasingly seen a good night's sleep or sleeping late in the morning as a sign of laziness or sloth, one of the cutest deadly sins, or worse, a lack of ambition. If we get tired during the day, instead of showing our soft underbelly and sleeping, we drink more coffee, or worse, we take an Adderall. That is, the wrong kind of supplement. The other party that shares some of the blame here is the media, especially the media who cover the science of this stuff. How many times have you heard that you need to get 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep? It's repeated so often it has become a platitude, even though it's essentially dangerous advice. Because for most of us, 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep is a fantasy, like reverse orgy porn. Google it. After the media starts listing all the bad things that happen if you don't get that 8 hours of unbroken bliss, when you have to wake up in 5 or 6 hours, sheer panic sets in. Panic and fear are not conducive to sleep of any variety. This chapter is designed to be the antidote to that panic and fear, providing a different perspective from which to view sleep. That said, if you're one of those slumbering unicorns who can get that 8 hours, holla fucking looya to you. The strategies we're about to cover are going to give you the best chance to sleep like a stone at night. If you already are a champion sleeper, then the only other thing I want you to take away from this chapter is this. Do not feel an ounce of guilt for getting some shut-eye. You need your rest. Quality sleep is a key ingredient to your health. It helps combat obesity. It improves the immune system. It's vital for optimal mental function and improves all markers of physical performance. Don't let anyone, not your boss, not your spouse, not your inner critic, make you feel bad for getting sleep. Because try as you might, and oh you might, you can't outsmart sleep. You have flirted with the idea that you'll sleep when you are dead. But if you truly believe that, then don't be surprised when death swipes right, puts on roller skates, and cruises on over to your crib. Because death is DTF. Owning it. Thankfully, more and more prominent and successful people are talking about the importance of sleep. Matthew McConaughey has publicly talked about needing 8.5 hours per day. Heidi Klum gets 10 hours every night. And that's with 2 kids. That is some serious beauty sleep. LeBron James and Roger Federer have both said they sleep 12 hours per night, half the day. Bill Gates has talked about his need for a solid 7 hours of sack time per night. He's jealous, he says, of short sleepers, people who can do with less. But for him, it is crucial to get his sleep. Jeff Bezos, the founder of a multi-billion dollar online empire, is right there with him. I just feel so much better all day long if I've had 8 hours. Here's the deal I can make with you. If you take your sleep seriously, you will get more done with less stress. For some, it sounds too good to be true, like golden eggs from a goose. But the productivity and lifestyle benefits of sleep have all been very well researched and well documented. It's a life hack that's not a hack, just a rule of the operating system. Outside nutrition, it's the single most important ingredient to owning the day, and you need to pay attention to how to do it well. Don't be a hero. Cycle your sleep. The topic of sleep is very personal to me. I'm a poor natural sleeper, and the busier I got as the CEO of Onnit, the more sleep became a stressor in my life. Why couldn't I just sleep like everybody else? It felt like something was wrong with me. I could not afford to have humanity's primary natural stress reliever become an additional source of stress in my life. It took some time, but finally the literature and counsel of my peers made me realize that we're all very different when it comes to sleep. Some of us are light sleepers, some heavy. Some can take a long time to get into sleep, some can sleep at the drop of a hat. My fiancé, Whitney Miller, was Miss United States and a sponsored surfer. She is currently a blue belt in jiu-jitsu and the host of Glory Kickboxing. But her biggest talent has nothing to do with any of that. It's sleep. The time between when she hits the pillow and when she enters sleep is nothing short of a superpower. I remember one time I told her I was going to count how long it took her to go to sleep. I said, "Ready, go." And she giggled and then closed her eyes. At 11 seconds in my silent count, she cracked up and started laughing out loud. "It's too much pressure," she said. I just smiled and kept counting. She closed her eyes again, and at 27 seconds, 16 seconds after she burst out laughing, I felt her body start twitching. The telltale sign of the nervous system entering shutdown. When I told her in the morning, even she was surprised. I've never been more jealous of anyone's abilities in my life. We're not all Whitneys, but we don't have to be. The important thing is to learn what you are, study your body, track your timing, take notes. Sleep homework might be the most important work you ever do, And if you do it right, one of the first lessons you will learn is that to do sleep well does not mean to do it all at once. Somewhere along the line, despite anthropological research to the contrary, we got this idea in our heads that proper sleep is a monolith that you do straight through, uninterrupted. And then, because it feels so impossible to so many of us, it immediately becomes yet another thing to put on the daily checklist to feel guilty about not doing right. Well, fuck that. Sleep should be relaxing. The last thing any of us need is the exact kind of pressure that creates unrealistic expectations and keeps us up at night stressing about why we're still awake. The reality is there are four phases to sleep: awake and resting, light sleep, deep sleep, and REM sleep. And while each of these phases is helpful, the two most important are deep sleep and REM sleep. In deep sleep, you release all the hormones to repair and rebuild your body. In REM sleep, you are basically rebooting the mental hard drive. A typical sleep cycle lasts 90 minutes and transitions from awake and resting to light sleep to deep sleep, finally ending in REM. After REM, it is common to wake up, though you may not remember it before you enter your next cycle. The key is, if you do wake up, not to stress. Instead, take a page from the books of other cultures, both historically and currently, who have no problem sleeping multiple times a day, something called polyphasic sleep. Currently, in cultures like Spain and Egypt, the siesta, or ta'asala, is an example of a type of polyphasic sleep in which people sleep about 5 or 6 hours per night, and up to 90 minutes, one sleep cycle, in the afternoon. The Kung of Botswana and the Efe of Zaire have a more fluid sleep pattern, basically sleeping any damn time they feel like it. In other tribal communities, our ancestors would sleep after dusk for 3 hours, wake for a few hours, perhaps smoke some tobacco or drink some tea, maybe have sex, and sleep again for a few hours before dawn. This was due in no small part to the fact that our ancestors never conceived of trying to outsmart the phases of sleep. Instead, they rolled with them as a natural part of being human. Expecting 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep out of themselves every night would have been borderline ridiculous, just as it is to expect it out of ourselves. Nick Littlehill and his aptly named book Sleep have been a major part of coming to that realization and expanding my views on sleep cycles and polyphasic sleep. You shouldn't, for example, count how many hours of sleep you get in a night, but rather how many 90-minute sleep cycles you get in a week. 35 cycles should be your target. It is a strategy Littlehill has used for some of Great Britain's best and busiest athletes and performers, including the legendary football club Manchester United and the UK cycling team. If 35 sleep cycles per week is the goal, that means the typical day should theoretically include 4 or 5 sleep cycles. Fortunately, they don't all have to come at night. In the siesta model, our Spanish and Egyptian friends sleep 3 or 4 cycles at night and 1 cycle in the afternoon. In Littlehill's model, sleep is even more fluid. A 30-minute nap, like the one we talk about in Chapter 9, which is only 1/3 of a full cycle, still counts as 1 point towards your sleep cycle goal. It's not extra or a bonus, it's part of your sleep regimen. So if you sleep 6 hours at night, you get 4 points. If you take a 30-minute power nap that day, you get an additional point, bringing you to 5. Do that every day of the week, and you have met your 35-point goal. If you get 7.5 hours of sleep one night, that's 5 points right there. You can put one in the bank for later with another nap, or just power through the day. Make sense? For many of you, a schedule with sleep spread evenly and regularly across the day might not be possible, and that's okay. The point is to recognize that cycles, and not total hours, might be the way to get your body the rest you need. Even if you have to work a full day, you can find creative ways to squeeze in the sleep. If you have a night when you don't sleep much, just do the math and adjust the points. It's something we intrinsically understand when we say catch up on sleep. Catching up is a real thing. The point of the cycles model is to take the pressure off a single day and spread it over something much more manageable, a week. Pro tip. track your sleep. There are a lot of sleep trackers through your smartphone that track your movement during the night. But honestly, they aren't all that accurate. If you are sleeping with a partner or a dog, the movement trackers have no way of distinguishing you from the other mammals in the room. They also have limited ability to track the difference between the cycles. So I stepped up my game and purchased the sleekest tracker on the market, the Oura Ring. It slips over your finger and processes all the biometrics needed to truly give you an accurate snapshot of your sleep. It will show you how much time you are awake, in light sleep, in deep sleep, and in REM. From there, you can really understand your sleep quality. What were the conditions that led to good sleep, or what Little Hale would call junk sleep? Junk sleep is like junk food. It will do the trick when you're hungry, but it isn't as healthy for you as real sleep. I started noticing correlations between sleep and caffeine, room temperature, even time of last meal. It gave me the data that allowed me to really understand what I needed to do to improve my sleep and when I needed to grab an extra nap or two. The problem with the Oura is that some nights you might think you got a pretty decent sleep, but the readings give you a poor score. Instead of feeling good, you mindfuck yourself into thinking that you are tired or exhausted. So it is key to remember that how you feel matters just as much as what the reading says. Master the data, don't let the data master you. Get your shit together. This is where the personal accountability of my personality kicks in. I cannot tell you the number of times I have worked with someone on their sleep, it didn't matter if they were an elite athlete or a regular Joe, and asked them what their sleeping environment looked like, only to find out it resembled a Tokyo robot disco more than an actual bedroom. Phones were on the nightstand within arm's reach, buzzers and dings and push notifications all turned on. Bright red and blue lights from cable boxes and electronics chargers illuminated the floor. Street lights and sunlight poured through flimsy curtains. There were cars and noise and dogs barking. The heat was cranked to infinity and beyond. And they wondered why they hadn't had a decent night's sleep in God knows how long. Fortunately, getting your shit together in the bedroom for proper sleep is not rocket science. It's a simple matter of adding a few key elements and removing others. All of them entirely within your control. No excuses. Wind down the temperature. When you don't have central heat in your home, it gets cold at night. Most of our evolution was spent without central heat, so we got used to sleeping when it was cold. Still, to this day, we sleep best when it is a bit colder than usual at night. Having a programmable thermostat like Nest is perfect to replicate that natural progression from warm to cool and back again. I tend to sleep from about 12:30 to 8 a.m., and my temperature schedule goes like this. 7:30 a.m., 73 degrees. 9 p.m., 71 degrees. Midnight, 69 degrees. 2:30 a.m., 67 degrees. 5 a.m., 65 degrees. 7:30 a.m., 73 degrees. Figure out what works best for you, but go ahead and drop the temperature around the time you're going to sleep. Your body will thank you. Eliminate blue lights. In Chapter 1, we talked about using blue light to help you wake up and recalibrate your circadian rhythms. If blue spectrum light exposure is good for waking, it only makes sense that you should limit and then eliminate it when you're getting ready for bed. By 10 p.m., all blue light should be out. Blue light counteracts the natural release of melatonin, the darkness signal in the brain that makes us sleepy, which is why exposure to screens is critical to regulating sleeping and waking. The brilliant stand-up comic and filmmaker Mike Birbiglia has a great way of thinking about it. His first film, Sleepwalk With Me, is all about his REM sleep disorder and how he had nearly died from his horrible sleepwalking habits. He says, "Think of sleep not as something that you crash into, but that you ease into. If your body is like a car, you want to park it, not crash it." Everything you did in the wind-down phase and every choice you make here is about throttling down your engine so you can coast smoothly into the garage of your sleep. Remember, sleep isn't binary. It's not an off switch. It's a dimmer. Power down the grid. We are energetic beings. This isn't woo-woo, hippy-dippy nonsense. This is science. We project an electromagnetic field, just like our electronics. Studies have indicated a correlation between sleep disturbances and exposure to EMF frequencies. So do your best to keep any high-powered devices away from your sleeping area. This includes, most importantly, your smartphone. This has a couple other advantages for your sleep. First, you won't be thinking about the email you might miss or the text message you've been waiting for if the phone isn't in the room. Out of sight, out of mind. Second, you won't be tempted to blast yourself with blue light if you can't sleep. Trust me on that one, I've been there. Tossing and turning, I've counted every last goddamn sheep in Scotland and then fired up my phone to browse all the sheep on Instagram too. Inevitably, I kept going and going down the internet blue light rabbit hole. Hours would pass, then I'd be stressed about what time it was, and instead of counting sheep, I'd start counting the minutes until I had to be up. It wasn't until I banished electronics from the bedroom that this impulse died down, and I stopped screwing with my melatonin production. Add green plants. Air quality matters. You can add high-tech filters to your HVAC system. You can bring in a humidifier or dehumidifier, provided it doesn't make too much noise and you tape over the power light. But nothing is quite like the fresh, oxygenating power of plants. They're a simple, cheap, effective way to get better sleep. The sleep messiah himself, Sean Stevenson, likes English ivy, NASA's top recommended air filtering plant, and the perennial snake plant, which is nocturnal and releases oxygen during the night rather than the day. Don't worry, you don't have to turn your bedroom into the little shop of horrors where the plants are dominating your space just to get the benefits. Just a few good plants will do. No friend zone. This is probably the hardest one for most households, including in Casa Aubrey, where I have failed to heed my own advice. But I'm going to move forward with unabashed hypocrisy, thanks to our little Alaskan klee-kai. The rule is that the bedroom is for sleeping and for sex only. Anyone with whom you wouldn't want to do both should be strictly verboten from the bedroom. If you are serious about sleep quality, this includes your best canine or feline buddy. I'm sorry, but there is only one kind of doggy style you should allow in the bedroom, and it doesn't come with whiskers. Hope you have better luck with this rule than me. Get yourself together. It's not just your environment that you need to get squared away to get good sleep. You need to get yourself straight as well. We've already spent time and energy regulating your nutrition and caffeine. We've been physical. You've hopefully had sex. So you're nearly there. All we need now is to add in the specific sleep-related tweaks that will bring the Sandman calling. Get secure. Sleep is an inherently vulnerable act. You are in the worst position to defend yourself from any potential threat. Whether it is a mosquito, a scorpion, a bear, or a deranged human being, sleep is an ambush waiting to happen. Plus, it is fairly normal for people to be a little wary of the things that go bump in the night. Even in a protected house, some instincts are just hardwired. Make a ritual out of locking your doors and setting your alarm if you have one. If you still want to err on the side of an abundance of caution, when you actually go to bed, the most secure sleeping position is going to be lying on your side with your dominant hand on top. In the unlikely event that you have to fend off an attack, this will give you the chance to do your best Liam Neeson impression and showcase your very particular set of skills. Sleep posture. Not only is sleeping on your side the most secure position, it is also generally the best position for breathing. Sleeping on your back is more likely to lead to snoring and sleep apnea, and sleeping on your stomach is going to cause shallower breathing, not to mention a lot of low back issues. There are exceptions, of course, particularly for those who have structural alignment issues. Regardless of which positions you end up rotating through during the night, you'll always want something that encourages a neutral neck position, which is generally a lot less pillow than you think it is, despite what the world's finer hotels would have you believe. As with everything else, test, try, take notes, and repeat what works. Nose breathing. Sleep apnea affects an estimated 22 million people in the United States. It's a condition in which the airway gets partially obstructed, mildly suffocating the sleeper, forcing her to wake up and readjust. It is massively disruptive to sleep cycles, as well as any unlucky partner in the bed with normal hearing, who has selfishly not grown accustomed to sleeping next to what you could easily confuse for a chainsaw with a sputtering motor about to run out of gas. Nose breathing isn't just good for cardiovascular training, it's also your first line of defense against apnea's assault on fluid sleep. There are a couple options to assist you on the nose breathing front. You can pursue medical intervention like balloon rhinoplasty, where they open up your nasal passages by inflating a balloon until snap, crackle, and pop, you can breathe again. Or you can start a little slower and less invasively with over-the-counter nose strips, just like the ones you see on your favorite NFL linebacker every fall Sunday. They pull open the nasal passages gently, allowing more air to pass into and out of your lungs and disengaging your face chainsaw in the process. Pro tip, did you do the do? A 2005 study showed that playing the didgeridoo, a long wind instrument native to Australia, every day for 4 months, significantly reduced participants' sleep apnea. Playing the didge, as it is affectionately called, trains you in what is called circular breathing, which requires intense control over your breath apparatus. This appears to translate into more control during the night when your unconscious self is in charge. In addition to sleep gains, playing the didge has also been shown to increase the number of invitations you receive to naked drum circle dance parties, which of course is why most of us want to do the do. Hydration. Waking up and going to pee is a problem. For one, to make sure you have your faculties about you to get up and use the restroom instead of your bed, your body releases small amounts of stress hormone that elevates your alertness just enough to bring you out of sleep. People who are sensitive to stress or who are normally poor sleepers can have trouble falling back asleep. To that end, being mindful of your fluid intake prior to sleepy time is important. I generally recommend that you stop intake of fluids a minimum of 60 minutes before bed. That is usually the least time it takes you to pass excess fluid. The exception here is if you have been drinking alcohol. Go ahead and continue drinking water right up to bedtime if that is the case. As for drinking water in the middle of the night, don't overdo it. More often than not, a little bit of water will satisfy your thirst until you can drink that big old hydration cocktail first thing the next morning. Prescription. Here is your down and dirty sleepy time checklist. 1. Don't stress about how much sleep you are about to get. If you don't get much, you can make up for it the next day or later in the week. Sleep is not a daily task, it's a weekly task. 2. Prepare your environment by eliminating heat, light, and electronics, and bringing in plants in place of your pets. 3. Prepare yourself by battening down the hatches, getting yourself into a comfortable position, breathing through your nose, and throttling down the fluid consumption. It's that simple, except when it isn't and you either can't fall asleep or can't stay asleep. If you're anything like me, you're going to be troubleshooting those issues a lot. That's why I developed an arsenal of tips and tactics to help me, including these two bad boys. Melatonin supplements. If you can't fall asleep, it could be because your body isn't producing enough melatonin. Perhaps you spent a little too much time watching your show or your bathroom lights really bright and your body didn't get the darkness signal it needed to produce melatonin. Using the minimum effective dose, usually 0.5 milligrams of melatonin, can really help you ease into sleep. Research indicates that more melatonin isn't necessarily better, however, so abide by the rule of minimum effective dose. It's also a good common sense rule to give yourself breaks, minimum 1 day off per week and 1 week off every 6, so your supplemental melatonin use doesn't become habituated. Emergency sleep cocktail. If you are in a phase where you're having trouble staying asleep, prepare this emergency sleep cocktail before bed and keep it on your nightstand. Emergency sleep cocktail. 1/4 teaspoon cream of tartar, dry spice. 1/4 teaspoon sea salt. 1/2 teaspoon turmeric. Dash of black pepper. Mix ingredients in 10 to 12 ounces filtered water. Drink. The sodium and trace minerals in the sea salt support your adrenal system. The potassium in the cream of tartar relaxes your muscles. And the turmeric, along with the black pepper to assist with absorption, helps reduce inflammation. If I don't end up waking up in the middle of the night and needing to knock it back, I will either drink this concoction with some water as a substitute for my morning hydration cocktail, or put it in the fridge for the following night, secure in the knowledge that I am well-armed to tackle my sleep cycle goals. Now do it. This is what I hope for you tomorrow. A day when you shoot out of bed 2 minutes before the alarm goes off, ready to face the world. When your joints don't crack, your head doesn't ache, and your stomach doesn't gurgle. When the light through the window feels like it was put there to warm you to perfect equilibrium with the world and kickstart you into the best day of your life. A day that you own completely, that you have been working hard to visualize, optimize, and create. Yet no matter how well you have owned this day, if you don't sleep, you will start to lose the hard-earned ground that you've won. Like an athlete who trains hard and recovers poorly, your gains risk becoming losses if you don't cement them with sleep. You have to do it. Just don't let this call to arms stress you out. Ease into the process of figuring it out if you need to. Change happens slowly. Take your time, relax, and let sleep happen. What I will not abide, my dudes and dudettes, is the notion that you don't have time to sleep. Unless you are Chuck Norris on an important mission, heed these words of advice clearly. Do less, do it better. A life well lived has balance, and a day well lived has plenty of sleep. You don't have to listen to me, though. You can take it from Winston Churchill. You know, the guy who helped save Western civilization when he was asked about his success in life. Never sit down when you can lie down. 3 pointers. We have made a mistake by thinking of sleep only in terms of hours per night. Instead, think about sleep as cycles per week. Understand that any form of polyphasic sleep, which includes napping, is a natural antidote to the anxiety of getting nighttime sleep and a supplement to your daily recovery. To play out any great act, you have to set the stage. When it comes to sleep, this means eliminating the blue lights, keeping distractions to a minimum, making your room cool and dark like you're a cave bear, and adding some plants to push some oxygen into your life. How you sleep will determine how you sleep. Generally aim for sleeping on your side in a secure position. If you're waking up in the night, try to manage your bedtime hydration, including minerals and electrolytes. Chapter 16. Bring It Home. No man ever steps in the same river twice, for it's not the same river, and he is not the same person. Heraclitus. Knowing what to do and why to do it are a big part of owning the day. Before you implement what you have learned, you are inevitably going to face a force called resistance. It will hit you from the outside and from within, so you need to acquire the tools to overcome it. You need to learn how to forgive yourself for past failings, how to motivate yourself to keep going, how to visualize your success, how to give yourself a pat on the back, and how to let your tribe know about your journey so they can support you in the struggle and celebrate you in success. Do it for them as much as you do it for yourself. Getting owned. It's hard to try something new. I get it. It's even harder to stick with it. 80% of people give up all their New Year's resolutions by February. Those 10 new faces you saw at the gym January 2nd? 8 of them will be gone by Valentine's Day. Of course, these are statistics drawn from people who have the time to fill out a survey. People who are crushing it don't fill out any fucking surveys. But it isn't just individuals who struggle to persevere and follow through with diets and gym memberships. Most small businesses fail. Most books don't make it to the end, and according to OG podcaster Jordan Harbinger, host of The Art of Charm, 95% of podcasts don't make it to their 13th episode. Why is this? Usually it isn't because the ideas are bad, though sometimes the ideas are really bad. It's because we weren't able to win the mental battle necessary to get us there. We got discouraged when we ran into unforeseen obstacles. We got derailed when we didn't get the results we were expecting. Or worse, we listened to the flood of voices giving us a million good reasons why we should stop. Sometimes the voices come from outside, from advertisers or people in lab coats telling you that it's not your fault, that you couldn't change if you tried. They are wrong. The science of epigenetics has shown that even many genetic characteristics may be changed by the choices we make. Chronic conditions are being reversed by ordinary people making extraordinary choices, like the ones described in this book. Sometimes the voices come from inside our own head, telling us we're not good enough, or we don't deserve it, or it's too late and we should have started earlier. As silly as it may sound, I heard those voices when I turned 30 years old. I'd found it on it earlier that year, and all it had done up to that point was lose money. I thought I must have zigged when I should have zagged, and now it was too late for me to ever have the life I was meant to live. Then I chose to stop feeling sorry for myself and do something about it. I borrowed money from my last two friends with any kind of bank balance just to keep the lights on long enough for Alpha Brain, the last bullet in the gun, to be delivered. My first big success. The author, Stephen Pressfield, has heard those same voices too. He even gave them a name. He called them collectively resistance. Resistance is that force that will oppose you every time you attempt to ascend, to improve, to achieve. Pressfield heard it all the way up until he was about 40 years old and decided he was finally going to fulfill his lifelong vocation and become a professional writer. He wrote 4 screenplays that were made into movies over the next 10 years and published his first book when he was 52 years old. It was called The Legend of Bagger Vance, and it went on to become a massive bestseller, as well as a feature film 5 years later. His second book, Gates of Fire, was a piece of historical fiction about the 300 Spartan men who made a stand at a place in Greece called the Hot Gates. They faced an army of 100,000 Persian fighters. They didn't retreat. They didn't surrender. They died fighting to the last man because they were Spartans. How did they defeat resistance? Silence those voices that told them they could never win, that there was no point, that it was hopeless. They had an ethos. Never give up, never surrender. Easier said than done. Ask anyone what the hardest thing is about doing something new or different or unheard, and they'll tell you it's sticking with it. Well, the Spartans stuck with it. They always did. Not just for themselves, but for their loved ones. The best chance they had to keep their beloved safe was to let every enemy know that if they crossed the boundary into Sparta, they better be ready for a war to the last man. That simple, singular ethos was what helped the Spartans send their message not just to the world, but down through history. That is the beauty of singular focus, and the reason we are focusing on a single day. You are going to get results the day you start, the moment you start. 40 minutes after you wake up, you are going to feel different than you have ever felt. That difference will compound like interest in the bank, and then the real transformation will begin. Owning it. Resistance is a cunning adversary, make no mistake. It is also a necessary force. What kind of game would we be playing if there were no monsters? How could we adapt to stress if there was no stress? How could we seek enlightenment if we were already enlightened? There is no light without dark, after all. No hot without cold. No silver lining without the black cloud. But just because resistance is necessary, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do everything in our power to kick its ass. Our goal is to own our life, not get owned by it. That's why we're going to help you build an ethos in this chapter that will give you the encouragement you need to silence the voices and overcome the resistance. But building an ethos isn't the only technique you're going to need. You will need to visualize your success. You will need to employ positive self-talk and rid yourself of self-ridicule. You will need the support of your tribe. But the first step you will need to take may be the hardest of all. It is for me. It's forgiveness. Forgive yourself. All you can do is your best. There is a good chance you have tried diets and transformational programs before and failed. Guess what? So has everyone. But you are not the same person you were then, and this is not the same program. You are the person who learned from those experiences, who appreciates owning life even more than you did then. For that knowledge to turn into wisdom, though, you have to forgive yourself for all your past failings. You did your best then, and your best now is different. There is a scene deep into the first season of one of my favorite shows on television, Billions, when genius fund manager Bobby Axelrod is talking to his brilliant psychotherapist about why he uncharacteristically blew a trade that cost his fund $1 billion. After hours of banter, he realizes that it was his guilt surrounding the manipulation of his friend for his own financial gain that caused him to subconsciously seek retribution on himself. He needed to pay the price to level out his internal scales of justice. This isn't just something from fiction, though. I've seen it 100 times. It is the motivation behind many forms of self-destruction. Whether in love or in business or in health, if we don't feel like we deserve a positive outcome, or even worse, like we deserve to be punished, we will manifest that outcome with the subconscious choices we make. If we don't forgive ourselves, all that knowledge from our past failures will instead petrify into useless information, and we will continue to believe deep down that we deserve to get beaten down by life. We will find ourselves, again and again, on the short side of the trade. But if we truly forgive ourselves completely, we will know that we deserve better. And we will create the kind of positive reality that allows billion-dollar empires to blossom from blue-collar roots. The reason this whole thing has to start with forgiveness is that your choices will never be perfect. Maybe you got frustrated in the car this morning, or sat too long in one position at work this afternoon, or ignored your kids when you got home tonight. That's okay. Your day is never going to be perfect. If there's anything about your day or your life that you need to own, it's that. You think I do everything I wrote about in this book every single day? I don't. But that doesn't mean I don't wake up and do my best the next day. Perfection is bullshit. It's just a ruse that our internal self-critic perpetrates on us to make us feel like shit. What's worse, if we allow the inner critic to punish us every time we fail to meet the standards of perfection, we'll stop trying altogether. We'll decide that it's better to pretend that it's someone else's fault, hiding behind excuses and rationalizations. If we know that when we fail, we will forgive ourselves, then we get to play from inspiration rather than fear. We'll be able to look our mistakes right in the eye, take the medicine, and move on. It's what any good coach does for his players. It's why Pete Carroll, head coach of the NFL's Seattle Seahawks and formerly of the collegiate powerhouse USC Trojans, has won so many titles. You need to be your own good coach. You have to teach yourself to learn from failure, not be defined by it. You threw an interception? Fine. Learn from your mistake. Get back in there and keep throwing. Just do your best. That's all you can ask of yourself. If your best doesn't get the results you were hoping for, forgive yourself, because your best isn't determined by the outcome after the fact with perfect clarity. It's decided moment by moment, according to the effort you put toward the intention you have set for yourself. They say that the ends don't justify the means. Well, they don't invalidate them either. Do your best. Remove the self-punishment for trying and failing, and let the rest sort itself out. Build your ethos. The Spartans had a very simple ethos: never give up, never surrender. Pete Carroll built one for his entire organization. Always compete. Protect the team. Leave no doubt. Play in the absence of fear. Stay in the moment. Support individuality. Be an excellent communicator. Have fun. Show lots of love. To own this day and own your life, you need to create an ethos of your own. Something that takes all the complex knowledge you've acquired from your failures and successes over the years and turns it into a code. One that is instantly memorable and unbreakable, and that becomes like a second operating system, an app that allows you to eliminate the time and energy you spend bargaining with yourself. In that sense, creating an ethos is a shortcut to mental override. Instead of taxing your willpower, you're leaning on a simple message that reminds you, this is just what I'm going to do. The key with an ethos is to make it something you can build on. You want small wins. What you don't want to do is say something like, I will never have sugar again. Then a week later, when your friend brings you a chocolate chip cookie, your ethos is smeared across your upper lip like a dietary Dirty Sanchez. Start with simple things. Like, when I promise people I am going to do something, I do it. That's a pretty good start. I will always forgive myself if I'm doing my best. That's another good start. I will choose one day and own it. That's a great one. Visualize. Every single peak performer I work with visualizes his or her success. I've always thought it was a silly question when people ask an entrepreneur, did you ever imagine it could be this big? Of course he did. To create it, you have to see it first. It's not just entrepreneurs. The speaker visualizes what she is going to say and the audience's reaction to it. The fighter visualizes what is going to happen in the cage. If you've ever watched The Ultimate Fighter, nearly every time they show a contestant doing sparring rounds in preparation for a fight, at the end of the final training round, their coach makes them walk around the octagon with their hands raised in triumph, visualizing their victory. This is not some old fighter superstition these guys are engaged in, like not talking to a pitcher in the middle of a no-hitter. Visualization is a legitimate, powerful force. In his book, You Are the Placebo, Dr. Joe Dispenza discusses dozens upon dozens of cases where the placebo effect made a dramatic change on someone's life. His point is that instead of letting it happen by accident, getting fooled by some sugar pill or a sham surgery, we should harness the placebo effect to our advantage. Visualization is a prime example of that intentional placebo at work, one we've already seen in this book with those study participants who visualized themselves lifting heavy weights and getting stronger as a result. The same principle applies with owning the day. Visualizing yourself doing it will have a positive impact. Employ positive self-talk. I've always known that I'm hard on myself, but I didn't realize just how brutal I was until one evening when I was driving home from work, replaying the day in my head. I had solved a pretty complicated series of problems at the office that day in a surprising and inspired way. Out of nowhere, I said to myself, "Good job, Aubrey. You did good today." It hit me like a blast from a bomb. My whole body lit up, I was flooded with warmth, and my eyes welled up. I don't know if I had ever told myself something like that before. In 34 years, I had never given myself permission to be proud of myself. I certainly told myself how much I sucked or failed or what a POS I was 1,000 times, but never pride, never, "Good job, buddy." I could acknowledge when I did something well, but I never said it to myself. I never told myself, "Good job." Finally, after 30 years, I got what I had never realized I was always looking for, and I got it from myself. Just a little pat on the back. Since then, my podcast has tripled, my company has doubled, and my life has been colored with a lot more joy. It's funny how a turning point can happen after something so trivial. In my coaching course, Go For Your Win, I have everyone choose a single phrase they can tell themselves whenever times get tough. They need it, we all do, frankly, because in the absence of success or in the presence of obstacles, forgiveness will only take you halfway. Positive self-talk is what picks up the baton for the final leg and brings you across the finish line of your day, of your mission, of your life. Get support from your tribe. No one is an island. And while all the individual personal work I've talked about in this chapter is essential to conquering resistance and owning the day, it's not yet enough, because we are tribal creatures and we need the support of our tribe to truly thrive. Psychologists agree that there are four keys to compelling positive action. 1. Know what to do and how to do it. 2. Believe it will work. 3. See the value. And 4. Get support from your community, tribe, and family. This entire audiobook has been about turning those first three keys in the locked door of your optimized existence. We've given you prescriptions detailing all the steps you need to take to own the day. We have hundreds of clinical studies backing up the science behind this strategy. And we have helped show you what can happen if you follow the strategy by owning it, or if you fail the strategy by getting owned. Now we need to make sure you turn that final key and open the door to your best life. Tell everyone about owning the day. Tell them when it is going to happen and make a big deal about it. As much as the digital environment has driven us into isolation from physical connection, we can also use it to support us. Announce it on your socials and hold yourself accountable. Have it be something that people are curious about. Tell them where the challenges were, what the big successes were. If you're not sure where to start, right now there are already thousands of members in the Own the Day Facebook community ready to hear your stories, help support your mission, and answer your questions. Maybe you have a genetic condition, one leg, or live on a planet with a different gravitational environment. The majority of the principles in this book should be applicable to you, whoever you are, but everyone is different, so we're not taking anything for granted. I'll be stopping by there frequently too, as will the best coaches we have at Onnit, to help you overcome that resistance and turn all your knowledge into wisdom. Prescription. Part of the problem with our current condition is that there is a ton of conflicting information. When people are confused about what they should do and how they should do it, they don't do anything at all. This book has been written to end the confusion. It takes you step by step through every single part of the day. It has broken down the prescriptions, the actions, and the mindset necessary. Maybe the breadth of everything is so great it feels overwhelming. That is when it becomes even more important to focus on the process, because you're not going to be able to put this book down and just randomly go out and own the day. It's going to take some personal reflection, some preparation, and some planning. Here are some practices to employ before you get started. Ho'oponopono. The Hawaiian kahunas, shamans, have a practice for radical forgiveness they call Ho'oponopono, the purpose of which is to get you to a completely clean slate, a state of mind called the zero state, also the title of a book by Joe Vitale. It is a simple dialogue you have with yourself or a loved one which requires you to say four things. We're going to focus it on yourself for now, but keep this in your medicine bag when you need to resolve a conflict with anyone else. 1. I love you. Love is the appropriate bond that can unify all aspects of yourself. To express this love sets the foundation for all the communication to follow. 2. I'm sorry. This is to clear you of any guilt you may carry for the times you've done yourself wrong, from negative self-talk to forcing your body to cope with way too much cheap tequila. 3. Forgive me. The humble act of asking for forgiveness, when sincere, is not often opposed. Grant yourself the forgiveness you seek. 4. Thank you. This is an expression of gratitude to your body and your mind, not just for the forgiveness, but for everything it has given you. It's gotten you this far after all, right? Say it to yourself. I love you. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Thank you. Now imagine all the things you judge yourself for. Think about everything you beat yourself up about. Keep saying it for each one of those things. Keep meaning it. Like a fighter landing the jab over and over again. Eventually, you will vanquish the judge and reach radical forgiveness. Then you will have to do it again. The hero is simply someone who does battle with his demons every day. I love you. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Thank you. Download the Ethos Brain app. Don't just build your ethos, write it down. Assimilate it into your brain and nervous system like a second spine. Stress test it and put pressure on it until the lump of carbon turns to a diamond. Knead it until the words become hard as bone. Your ethos, whatever it is, may start a little bit softer and more pliable when it is young. That is only natural. So when you fail early on, don't get discouraged and throw it away. Put in the work to strengthen it instead, because when it is fully grown into your second spine, it is the thing that will keep you upright when everything else is trying to keep you down. See your future. I want you to imagine yourself a year from now. You know that in a year you are going to be different, whether you do nothing or something. And the choices you make between now and then will determine that difference. But for today, I want you to imagine owning all those other days. Visualize that you wake up with purpose and clarity. You push yourself against resistance. You take control of your diet and supplementation. You turn dead time into alive time. You work effectively and aren't afraid to power down the engines to rest. You train your body into a durable, capable machine. You connect with yourself, your friends, and the universe. You turn sex into an adventure of pleasure. You go to sleep with a mission and actually sleep. Imagine what a year of living like that has done for you. Walk in the shoes of that new person. See yourself through that person's eyes. Look in the mirror at that body. Maybe the circles under your eyes are gone and that stubborn weight has lifted mentally and physically. See what has happened in your career and in your family. That person is you, on the other side of resistance. If you see it clearly enough, it will be done. Create your mantra. Let's go, champ! This expression blasted across the public consciousness when heavyweight fighter Shannon Briggs dropped it on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. He talked about a dark time in his life where he felt he was at a crossroads. He developed the expression to help him push through the challenges, to buoy him during downtimes as a kind of magic spell against the wizardry of resistance. It became his mantra, a potent form of positive self-talk, holstered and ready for the first sign of turbulence. The expression I learned to tell myself, the expression that became my mantra, is go, hero, go. Maybe my favorite mantra, however, comes from editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, Jason Pfeiffer. From the time he started working for a regional magazine, he would tell himself the same thing every day. I'm not fucking around. Monday, not fucking around. Tuesday, not fucking around. Wednesday, you get the idea. This is really what this book has been about. Whether it is work or play or fitness or fucking around, to own your day, you are not fucking around. Find your own mantra and use it daily. You will not regret it. Unless it's something like, the bomb is in the building. That you might regret if you say it at the airport. Tell the world. When you have everything ready to own the day, mark the day on your calendar and tell your whole world. Go to the prescription section in each chapter and write down exactly what you are going to do. Focus on each little thing. If something isn't possible, don't worry. This is not binary, this is cumulative. If you have questions, log into the Own the Day Facebook group to get answers and gather support. Then just focus on the process. Before you know it, you won't just be owning the day, you'll be owning your entire life. Now do it.